Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Exciting show today. The superintendent-in-chief of the Boston Police Department is going to be with us, Daniel P. Linsky. He's giving a presentation at the IEEE Homeland Security Technologies Conference going on in Boston in the middle of November. His talk is titled Lessons Learned from the Boston Marathon Bombing, and he's got some interesting things to say and fields some pretty tough questions. You're going to really enjoy that. And in the second half hour, Adrian Hopkins to Merck. Merck is giving away massive amounts of pharmaceuticals to combat river blindness. Nobody knows about this, so we want to catch up with him, and it's not been easy. He's been hard to find. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, our Fountain of Useless Information, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments of the Voice of Reason. All that coming up. But right now, let's get to our interview with Dan Linsky.
Stand by.
Today, we're really lucky to have with us the superintendent-in-chief of the Boston Police Department, Daniel P. Linsky. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Not a problem. Thank you.
You're delivering a very important a talk at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in mid-November, and I was quite taken with the title of it, Lessons Learned from the Boston Marathon Bombing. And I imagine there were plenty of lessons learned. Can you give us kind of a preview of what you're going to tell us?
Sure. I think one of the lessons we learned is that, you know, prior problem planning helps, and that we had done training the previous couple of years for a Mumbai-type style attack on the city of Boston, and had started thinking and prepping towards the challenges that would entail. And it was that groundwork that had been laid previously that helped get some of the decisions made and some of the things done that day. The other thing that helped was cops with just their bravery and their intuition and their adapting to their circumstances and coming up with their own solutions that no one had talked about or trained for and responding in that way. But there certainly prior planning and training had a big effect on getting as many people as we did to the hospitals as quickly as possible, and also eventually shutting down the town and finding the suspects responsible.
You were incredibly efficient in this, moved very, very rapidly. Everything seemed to get into place extremely fast. And it had to be quite a trial with you, because you not only had your own response, you're primarily responsible, being the superintendent-in-chief of the Boston Police Department, but also you surely had to deal with counterparts in the FBI and Homeland Security and others. How did that command unit come about? Was there some turf wars there, or everything decided ahead of time how everything was going to work if something were to happen?
So the benefit is that we've got a great team in the region that works together all the time, and we had trained together, right? Some of the training we had talked about just previously with the Urban Shield training, we trained together with our regional partners. It started out with myself, the state police commander, and the head of the governor's Homeland Security team, along with the city Homeland Security team, and, you know, my counterparts on the fire and EMS side of the house, coming together in the middle of Boylston Street is... ambulance was rolling in, patients were rolling out, and having conversation about, okay, these are our priorities, this is what we need to do, and let's get it done. And I can tell you there were no egos. You know, we were very quickly joined by the special agent in charge, Rick Deloria of the FBI, and my police commissioner. And we got into a hotel room, and we just started to do what we had to do, which was secure the crime scene after triaging and transporting the victims, mitigating the EOD concerns that we had, evacuating people from the area, getting a message out to the public on social media, letting people know what was going on, and then protect the city. You know, we were afraid we might be seeing the first rounds of a Mumbai-style attack across the city. So we had to start protecting critical infrastructure. National Guard came in. The general jumped into the circle with us. Everyone just talked about what they had available for assets and what was needed to be done. And we just started ticking off items. And it didn't matter whether you were – and also our MBTA police, a transit police chief and deputy chief were right there. And we'd all work together. We've trained together. We've worked together. We've grown up our organizations together. There was no turf battles. It was, hey, here's a challenge. Who's got people we can throw at the challenge, and we just we did it. And that played out again in Watertown. You know, I'm the superintendent chief of the Boston Police Department. There were 1,000-plus officers and agents mm-hmm. from a myriad of departments and agencies in a parking lot in Watertown. The commissioner, the chief of Watertown, the FBI SAC, they directed a 20-block perimeter, and they turned to me and said, get it done. And I jumped on the hood of a car with a bullhorn, started giving directions, and nobody asked, who is this person giving directions? They just asked, what can we do, and where do you need us to do it? It was the officers, the agents, the troopers. It was National Guardsmen who pulled into their parking lot without ammunition, without weapons, who had armored Humvees, and said, Chief, where do you need us? We have no guns, but we'll take you guys. We've got the armored vehicles. We'll go out with them. And those kids stole shoulder to shoulder with our cops. And nobody asked who was in charge or who were you to tell me direction or order. We had a mission. We had a goal, and we accomplished it.
Well, for those of us not involved but looking in from the outside, when something runs this smoothly, it appears to us to be, you know, easy. But we know, those of us who know a little bit about some of these things know that it wasn't. You had to shut down all transportation. I presume you had to get a hold of Massport, Logan Airport, and other places and say, hey, look, you know, we got to stop the flights. You got to worry about the bus and the transit and the other things in and out of town. And also, you had to keep the streets free for getting these ambulances and in and out and getting people to the hospital. It had to be an incredible coordinated effort, and without the training, it certainly couldn't have run this smooth.
No, without training and without identifying gaps in that training. So the previous trainings we've done, we've identified problems and challenges, and we've sought to meet those challenges and fix them. And our radio systems were up and running, where officers coming in from to the region to assist us could flip on a channel on their own radio and be talking to us directly. And we figured out the communications problems and the logistics problems previously, and started dealing with them, and just kind of ticking boxes off from our previous experiences. Now we had other problems. You know, there's never going to be everything that runs smoothly, and there were definitely challenges that presented themselves, and we had to improvise, adapt, and overcome. And you know, there's always lessons learned as far as things we could have done better. There were some things that went very, very well and things that went wrong. And our challenge now is to share those with individuals around the country and the globe so that they can learn from the things we did well and learn from our mistakes to not repeat them.
Well, getting around old Boston, even when there isn't a problem, is a problem because of the old city and the way it was set up. Give us some. I don't know if you can without breaching some confidence, but could you give us an idea about maybe what some of the problems were you ran into that you're addressing now?
Yeah, you know, so there's some stuff I can't go into that comes up in the investigation, but I can tell you know, logistics was an issue as far as, you know, we had all these police officers who had been up since the night before, now dealing with either securing the crime scene and staying shift after shift, mm-hmm. Trying to get our off-duty personnel in and relieve people who are on their feet too long. We certainly need to do that better. We were sending food downrange to offices when they were in Watertown in the middle of the search, and it didn't make it to the offices. It was making it to offices on the perimeter. We didn't have a good system in place to verify that the offices who were in the inner perimeter got what they needed. So those are some challenges. I had a supervisor who took control of Boylston Street when the bombs went off and coordinated the emergency first responders' response in there, making sure that they stayed over to the side of the road and didn't block the street. And in Watertown, a bunch of us jumped out of our cars to get to the officers who were in the gun battle and who were calling for assistance with an officer down. And, we jumped out and took our keys with us. And then when the suspect took off in his vehicle, we wound up with a bunch of vehicles that were blocked in because officers were on foot doing different assignments and the street was blocked. And that cost us some time. We, issues with self-deployment where officers would, they're looking to do the right thing. They're in the hunt for the suspect. They get information comes in over a 911 call or a tip. It hasn't been evaluated yet. And, you'd had officers who would self-deploy and rush to that call. Mm-hmm. And in some instances put their own selves in harm's way.
Sure.
So those are some of the challenges that presented themselves that day. And one of the things that worked well that day is the community. They were phenomenal. They listened to us. They knew what we were up against. They were our partner. And by staying home and allowing us to do our job, those suspects are in custody today.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because staying home, of course, is one of the things that you've been criticized for. You had the curfew and you had it on for a while, and after a while, people were saying, why are we doing this? Why is that happening? And of course, there was a lot of pressure on you. It had to be to release the curfew. And in fact, when you did, and people came out of their house, is when a resident discovered the surviving suspect. Do you have a response, something to say to these critics? How would you answer that?
Yeah, based on the information we had at the time, I called my wife, I called my mother, and I told them to stay inside because the information we had at the time, there were people in danger and in harm's way, and we had to do to mitigate that threat. So I wouldn't treat any member of the public less than I would my own personal family. So if that's the advice I was giving my family, I think that's the advice I was giving the public, and they did. They listened, and we shut down the city of Boston in the middle of the winter sometimes for snow, and we asked people to stay off the roads and don't go out and let the plow crews plow the streets because it's dangerous and has to happen. And we get great cooperation on those blizzards, and we get great cooperation with the terrorism, and the public responded perfectly to it.
Yeah, I guess
that kid couldn't get out of the backyard. He couldn't get away. And he's in custody today.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that in a snowstorm, of course, people can leave their house. They just are not, they're asked not to drive. In this particular case, the surviving suspect was located just as soon as as one of the residents did believe that he could come out of the house without violating the curfew. So I guess the question is if you would have lifted it sooner, would you have found the suspect sooner?
Hindsight's always 20/20. I don't think so. And if we had lifted it sooner, we wouldn't have had a thorough search of the area that we were trying to secure. And hindsight's always 20/20.
Yeah, that's always, of course, the case. But hiding in the boat with the cover off the boat when you asked the people that actually searched out that area, hey, how come you didn't notice that boat with the cover missing and find the guy in there? Was it just that there was you were too thin, or was it what did the people that were searching that area, how did they respond to you when you asked them about that?
So the cover was on the boat. He was covered inside the boat, and we don't know whether he was in the boat the whole time. He might have been in one location and then sought refuge there someplace mm-hmm. else. So he could have been moving as teams were moving around the area. We don't have an answer to that. It was an area that was within our search zone. However, we had numerous instances of 911 calls, reports of people seeing suspects in basements or hearing people in their attics.
Oh, yeah.
And teams having to leave their assigned sectors to go respond to a crisis.
Oh, yeah.
And then coming back to their assigned sector. So if it was the possibility that the team was searching that area and started towards that house and responded to one of the many 911 calls and challenges that came in that day, and then when they went back to do their search, maybe didn't hit the yard as thoroughly as they should have. We don't know the answer to that at this point.
Well, you had a lot of ground to cover, and so we understand that. The point is that you did effect the arrest, you did stop any further problems, and it was an incredible thing, and almost a beautiful concert, the way that you put everything into place so rapidly and got everything under control. I presume that other major cities are probably calling you on the phone pretty often and saying, hey, what tips, you know, can you give us? And that leads another question to me, too. When we think of cities that are really, really prepared for this sort of thing, we think of New York City, and the chief there, Kelly, have you had numerous conversations with New York?
Yeah, we've always learned a lot of great things from New York, and New York is a very big supporter of Boston Police. We're very big supporters of New York Police. I can tell you, less than 2 hours after the explosion, standing next to me in my command center was a member of Ray Kelly's intelligence team from NYPD, who was off duty, heard the explosions, and got himself here to Boston to see if there was anything he could do to help out. He's somebody who works with us on a daily basis as far as our information and intelligence sharing. So we've taken lessons learned from New York. We've sent folks down there to find out what we could do better to prep. They certainly picked our brains as to what we did well. We've had police agencies and law enforcement agencies, government and homeland security agencies from around the globe who have either visited us or asked us to come visit and share best practices. And, you know, the commissioner encourages that. We're better off today. We were better on April 15th. Due to learning lessons from other departments and other tragedies that our law enforcement brothers and sisters have faced across the country and what they did in dealing with them. And some of those lessons learned helped us respond as well as the team did.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
I have the privilege of working with an incredible team of law enforcement professionals in the Boston Police Department, our partners in the other law enforcement agencies we work with in the region, our brothers and sisters in the EMS and fire service. We have an incredible team. We have trained well. We know each other before the crisis occurs and work well together. And I have never been prouder of the men and women of the Boston Police Department and what they did. You know, so we can set the infrastructure up. We can do some of the training. But those officers on their own adapted. They responded. They used ingenuity. They put themselves in harm's way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not only that, but they were in a lot of danger, too.
And they changed the world. They saved lives that day. So just to say that I'm proud of my team and proud of being a part of this team.
All right. Superintendent and Chief of the Boston Police Department, Daniel P. Linsky, is going to be delivering an address at the Homeland Security Technology Conference. IEEE is producing that in November 12th to 14th at the Westin Hotel in Waltham, Massachusetts. You can learn more about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link to their website. So we'll look forward to seeing you there in Boston at the conference in mid-November. Chief Linsky, thank you so much for your generous gift of time. We really, really, really appreciated having you on the program.
No problem, Colonel. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, we have a couple of minutes before the break, and it's always fun to check in with our friend Nick. Nick Nascimento, California, and a geek to go. Hey, Nick, what is fake Insta? I'm sure I must be pronouncing that correctly. SMS Trojan and its variants. Give us a rundown on that.
Oh, okay, now this is when we're looking at what people really aren't paying much attention to right now, and it's the fastest growing segment. You have to understand, these people are out to make money, and it's a numbers game. So they go where all the numbers are, where the most vulnerabilities are. Mm-hmm. The last thing people are thinking right now, and I can't tell you how low the percentage is of people who think of it or even have protection, is their smartphone. The smartphones we carry in our pockets are computers. computers can be taken advantage of, and these people are finding ways to attack them. Now, the fake inst, what it's short for, is fake install, SMS Trojan, and there's all sorts of variants of it. What it is you know, you get your apps, all your little things that kids like to play with, and the apps we use to, you know, check the weather or whatever, and sports and this and that. There's a lot of third-party websites out there that provide these applications. You have to be careful where you go, because you'll go get even a popular app like Instagram or Opera, Skype, mm-hmm. anything like this, and you install what you think is Instagram on your phone, and it's actually this fake install. And what it does, what it's designed to do, is then use your money to start in your phone to call a bunch of premium places, those places that charge by the minute. And that goes right onto your phone bill.
Wow.
Now, these have been kept down to a minimum so far. These have really hit hard in Europe and some parts of Asia, but we're just now seeing them here in the United States starting to grow as of about 6 weeks ago. So everybody can do it. Many companies have it. It's very simple to find. Go on to your app store and look for any free or paid version, because many of them are just as good, of malware and virus protection for your mobile phone.
All right. Really good advice. You know, Nick, a number of people are saying that what we need to do is scrap the internet altogether and rebuild from the beginning, get rid of what we have, and just come out with an entirely new internet. Do you hold with that, or do you think we're going to continue to be able to fight these battles?
Well, this is all going to change. There's really a two-part thing here. The internet as it's built now is very, very inefficient. And it can be rebuilt. There are companies that are using the model of how it could be rebuilt as we speak, and they're taking advantage of that. The people that are helping to send out information and stream information mm-hmm. and do mass file sharing. I think I can explain that very simply as in this fashion. When the internet was built, of course, we never knew it was going to be this big. You know, we already ran into trouble with the IP addresses. There weren't quite enough numbers. You know, they're doing the top-level domains, as in .com, .net. Pretty soon we're going to have .whatever the heck, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because we're running out of places to build. And there's millions and millions of websites coming up every single day. But that's not the main problem. That's a numbers thing that can be fixed. The bandwidth issue is what the problem is. And we could make it much more efficient than it is today. The way things work now, let's say I'm going to send you a song, okay?
Okay?
I'm going to send you a song, and I send you a file, and I send it to your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Your computer says, oh, I'm getting ready to receive this song, and I'm telling you I'm going to send you this song. It's going to send you a few bits of it. Then you're going to send back, yeah, I got those few bits. Then I'll send you a few bits more, and you'll send me back, I got those few bits. And that just goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, which is terribly inefficient. Back in the days when we had, you know, remember the modems? Boop, 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 boop. Remember those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
When it was over phone lines and noisy and junky,
mm-hmm.
we needed that type of confirmation that every single bit was going across. But now, all the technology exists and the bandwidth exists to where what should happen is, I'm going to send you this song. Here comes the song. Zoom. Did you get it? Yeah. Thank you. Bye. Very much shorter of a conversation, more efficient,
sure.
and that would bring down the bandwidth usage and a lot of the errors, and it would make it so much more efficient. Now, how do you rebuild a bridge after it's already been built and there's 100 cars on it? That's the problem that has to be done. It's an infrastructure issue. But yes, it could be rebuilt, and it's probably going to be an issue where once we max out, we're going to build it in parallel and transfer over to it. But I think that is going to have to happen at some time, because this is just growing every single day, so it's going to have to be done.
Do you see any? Okay, Nick from ageek2go.com. Thanks a bunch for checking in with us again, bringing us up to date, and keeping us in good shape. Now we're going to stick around for the next half hour, because we finally caught up with Adrian Hopkins. He's with Merck Pharmaceuticals. Been trying to reach him for forever, ever since we found out about the massive giveaway of pharmaceuticals to stave off and cure river blindness. He's a fascinating guy. It's the next half hour. So right now we're going to take a quick break and be right back. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Whom in the den of strangers will we meet today?
Arthur M. Schlesinger, Sr., Harvard Law. America has achieved the greatest measure of political freedom known to history. But Americans individually have never before possessed so little intellectual and spiritual freedom.